Good evening. James McCanney here with my Science Hour. It is January 2nd, and this new year, I'm going to try and take a somewhat of a new direction, a positive direction. 2013, what a disaster. Write 2013 down as one of the biggest disasters years. They said 2012 was supposed to be the end of the world, but for a lot of people, 2013 pretty much took the cake. At any rate, turning a new page, going into the future, what we have to do is look in a positive direction. Look at what we can do for ourselves to better our own lives, because it's not coming from any place else. So what I have been doing in the past weeks is building up and talking about the formation of solar systems, an odd topic to talk about when then discussing how to live, but that's really what it amounts to. And in doing this, you will actually find out why the tremendous amount of effort to throw bad science at you, you know, that the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago and nothing has happened since. It's this static clockwork in which nothing really changes. Comets come in, comets leave, and there's supposedly little dirty snowballs. Nothing changes. And actually, nothing could be farther from the truth. We live in an extremely dynamic environment. It changes minute by minute. The sun's conditions change minute by minute, and right now we are in a solar doldrum. We have been in solar doldrums for a long time, and the northern climates are being punished with severe winters. This is not global warming. The concept that the food line is being pushed northwards is simply incorrect. I mean, there were a couple warming years. But what we're heading into now is a cooling cycle with very low energy from the sun and very low electrical energy from the sun. We saw, for example, Comet Ison was a fairly powerful small comet, but in reality, it didn't live up to expectations at all. I'm not just talking about the NASA prediction of comet of the century type predictions. I'm talking about the fact that the Comet Ison developed some very interesting characteristics. It interacted with Mercury. It interacted with Mars in a big way. But all in all, it was very low energy in terms of what comets could be. At any rate, the main science topic tonight, I will be continuing the theme of solar system formation and positive science. That's going to be my theme for 2014. And we've been fighting misinformation, bad science from the standard science community, and on and on. And so it's time to push forward in the positive vein and create a lifestyle. Just a couple of quick notes here before I get started. An interesting thing happened, I guess in the recent past, in terms of Wikipedia, that supposed free, open, online encyclopedia, has been completely taken over and with political correctness written all over it. But my name doesn't exist on Wikipedia. There was a time when it did, when it was kind of a slamming James McCanney type of posting, and they even took that down because it just draws attention to me and funnels people to my website. So now young students going to Wikipedia to do science projects or whatever will not have any reference to James McCanney. As far as Wikipedia is concerned, I don't exist. So anyway, but the point is that Wikipedia, Google, all of these entities, Facebook, Twitter, let's go down the laundry list of Discover Magazine, Science Magazine, Nature Magazine, National Geographic, Discover Magazine, did I already say that once? And on and on and on, are all controlled. I wouldn't say they're all owned by the CIA, but they're all controlled. And we find that control goes back to basically the New World Order. And it's the European Rothschild banking community that operates the world banking system. And, of course, the issue here is keeping the public informed with real science, where before, remember that back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, standard science kind of had free rein. And then I entered the scene and was really the first person to, in the halls of ivory, contradict standard science, where I was right there, like at Cornell University, putting it in their face, at their location, using their data, etc. And so I've been successful. In fact, I've been so successful that that's the reason for a lot of the grief I get. Okay, so I'm not going to concentrate on that, but just a rather humorous note, as far as Wikipedia is concerned, I don't exist. Okay, just a quick update here. When Comet Ison was moving through the solar system, and of course it is defunct now, nobody has found really any remnants of Comet Ison. After its close passage to the sun, it of course appeared after it came around the sun, but many sun-grazing comets meet their demise near the sun because of extremely harsh conditions. And by the way, there's no way a little snowball would ever even get close to the sun with its extreme conditions. I mean, that's so absurd that it's beyond Mickey Mouse science. But at any rate, when Comet Ison was moving through the solar system, I made a prediction that if it continued on its path, its predicted path, then around the date of January 14th, 13th to 14th, someone there starting possibly as early as the 11th, we could see some interaction, some weather interaction with Comet Ison, because we would have a Jupiter, Comet Ison, Earth, New Moon, and Venus cross-solar system interaction. But of course, now Comet Ison is out of the equation. It's not going to be there. But here's the humorous part. When I made my prediction a number of days afterwards, NASA, in their flurry of trying to head Jim McCaney off at the pass, had a guy write a paper. And he said, a magical stream of fine red dust particles, this is due to some computer simulation, hocus pocus, the fine red dust streamer came out of Comet Ison. One was directly at where Earth would be on January 14th, and the other one was supposed to go around the sun in the path of Comet Ison and then whip around and also meet at Earth, so we would be in this supposed crossfire of red particle dust. Now remember that this was a standard science effort to try and neutralize my prediction of what I called, what the ancients called, the red hand of death. And I said if Comet Ison connected into the area around Jupiter and pulled in some sulfur dioxide, we could actually connect and sort of trade tails or do an electrical connection with Comet Ison, which would be up and above and behind us, and we could see some fine red powder coming into the upper atmosphere. And I made it clear that nobody was going to die from this, that the term red hand of death was an ancient term. But the point was that we could see this confirmed. And, of course, now Comet Ison isn't here anymore. So that, of course, could not possibly happen due to Comet Ison. But remember that the so-called cover story for standard science occurred. the streamers left Comet Ison long before it disintegrated. So now what we're going to see is on January 14th, when nothing happens, the prediction of standard science will be the laughable results will show that they were completely wrong. But anyway, that's just a way they have of getting caught in their own little devices. I think that's rather humorous. Just a quick update. This past week, there was an earthquake, an underground landslide in the Canary Islands. It caused about a 5.4 earthquake, 5.4 in the Richter scale earthquake in the Canary Islands, and there was speculation that that could lead to a volcanic eruption, which would then lead to an earthquake, which could start a tsunami, and that could wipe out the east coast of the United States. And so anyway, that's speculation and more speculation. The standard science geologists came out and said, no, don't worry about it. Very minimal chance of a tsunami. But remember, in Italy a couple years ago, there was a volcano. And I think it was Mount Etna, but I'm not sure. I think it was Mount Etna. And the volcanologist in Italy said, no, no big deal. The rumblings are just normal. The precursor rumblings of the volcano were normal, and so don't worry. Then there was a major eruption, and the people were not prepared. And so they actually were taking these scientists to court on criminal charges, and that's something I reported on when that all happened back a couple of years ago. And so anyway, I never found out the fallout. I think the scientists were exonerated and released, but it sent somewhat of a shockwave through the science community that these scientists who sit on government panels and actually give out official information that could be detrimental or bring warnings to the public, that they were actually responsible. Whereas, for example, in the United States, let's look at the Hurricane Prediction Center, which every year is just bafflingly wrong about what they're predicting. They have no accountability. They still get their government paycheck and have no accountability at all. But I did make a quick posting on my webpage dealing with the earthquake situation in the Canary Islands, and I noted that a researcher, the lieutenant governor of Minnesota back in the mid-1800s, Ignatius Donnelly, who wrote The Antediluvian World, Atlantis and the Antediluvian World, meaning the downfall, the implication that along with Atlantis came a huge flood, and that what they were seeing in Minnesota, in the Midwest, and as the pioneers worked their way through the United States, what is now the United States, back in the mid-1800s. And remember, at that point, most of what we consider the United States now were not any states at all. They were just territories and very roughly defined areas. But he said, in his studies, as did all of the naturalists of the time, that the United States showed great evidence of the Great Flood. And so that was one of Velikovsky's points, that by the 1900s, all of the Great Flood evidence, like washes with tree stumps all snarled together, etc., all of the evidence had been destroyed by man and his progress to clean up and build on the housing and roads and etc. But at any rate, speaking of Ignatius Donnelly, he wrote a book in which he described his youth growing up in the Pennsylvania coal fields. And what they showed was that there were layers of coal, then gravel on top of that, then another layer of coal, then another layer of gravel, then another layer of coal. And so repeatedly, there was at intervals in geological time, there were intervals in which the coal had formed. And one of the things that Velikovsky had pointed out was that coal could not possibly form from slow decaying plant life, that when you look at coal, in fact, I have a piece of coal in front of me right now that came off of a coal train that came out of the western states. And you look at a piece of coal, it's fossilized plant material that's built up, compressed into rocks, and basically it's plant material that's all compressed. And so it never had time to disintegrate, to change into dirt or any other form. And so some coal is very dry. Some coal does not have any oil or volatiles in it at all. And other coal is very rich in oils and all sorts of hydrocarbon chemicals. And that's what makes it produce so much heat, is because you're actually burning not just the coal, but all of those chemicals and oil along with it. And that's what gives real rich coal, so to speak, its tremendous amount of heat generation properties. But the dry coal, of course, occurred when there was no influx of oil. The wet coal, so to speak, the coal that's impregnated with a lot of hydrocarbons, occurred when a large comet was passing by. And it's very important to understand these principles, because as we harvest coal, for example, or as we look at the layers of coal in Pennsylvania, you see that this happened repeatedly. A number of years ago, there was a tsunami that was generated by the earthquake over in Sumatra. That created a tidal wave that hit the east side of the mini continent, or you might call it, of Madagascar. It's a great big island off the east coast of Africa. The tsunami took vast amounts of vegetation miles inland and dumped and deposited it. And it was a perfect example of the formation of coal, dry coal. In other words, it happened without the influx of oil. So that coal, once it's compressed and changes into somewhat of a sedimentary rock type of formation, with all the water that's compressed out of it, leaving only the dry carbon of the plant material, that will be dry coal. And so it would be interesting to look at the layers in the Pennsylvania coal fields to see if it's a dry or wet. Wet meaning with hydrocarbons, a lot of chemicals from the hydrocarbons that would have rained in from the comet tail as the comet passed by. In other words, the comet nucleus, of a large nucleus, planetary size probably, would come by, set up a gravitational wave that would set off the tsunami, which would drive the plant material inland, deposited it, and then at the same time dumping hydrocarbons. That's where the wet oil comes from. And so, at any rate, it would be interesting to examine the Pennsylvania oil coal fields to see if they're laden with oil or not. This brings up another great example in Canada of the tar fields up there, or in the Orinoco region of Venezuela, where there's the tar fields. This is also areas in which tremendous amount of hydrocarbon, the tars, the very heavy, the long hydrocarbon chains came in and were deposited as we passed through the tail of a large comet. So at any rate, back to the Canary Islands, I made mention that it's very possible, very likely, that the tsunamis that created the Pennsylvania oil and coal fields was actually due to volcanism and landslides in the Canary Islands. And if that were the case, we'd have to do some more studies. That means that the ocean wave, the tsunami tidal wave, made it all the way into Pennsylvania. That means everything east of there would have been wiped out, washed away, and dead, basically killing off all life east of there. And of course, this is over geological time. So very possibly it was not inhabited by man at the time, or if it was, any remnants of those civilizations had been washed out to sea. Or the other possibility is that those layers were from repeated passages of some object that came through the solar system, or many objects. And I know at this point some people would jump up and down and say, Planet X, it's proof that Planet X exists. And all it proves is that that it needs more study. It could be due to simply the regular periodicity of volcanic activity in the Canary Islands, but all the volcanoes of the Earth, the activity with all the volcanoes of the Earth, go back to the breaking of the Holocene period, in which the mastodons and the saber-toothed tigers died off, and which ushered in the tremendous onset of modern man, with a lot of the small animals making it through, but of course the big animals, in that was a period of immense glaciation also. So just remember in my weather book that I talk about all of these stages and the progress and what happens when a large comet comes through the solar system, all of the various effects. So at any rate, are we? Is the eastern United States going to be destroyed by a tsunami from the Canary Islands? I don't know. I can't predict. I wouldn't say yes. I wouldn't say no. It's hard to predict. It's very difficult to predict. But at any rate, I thought it was interesting to note that in the past, many, many tsunamis have made it all the way into the far into the depths of Pennsylvania. It would be possibly something I should put on my list. Or kids out there, too. Kids that live in Pennsylvania, it'd be a wonderful school project to go out there, collect oil from the shale oil layers in Pennsylvania, and from the various layers catalog them and see if they're rich in oil, hydrocarbons, or if they are of the dry variety of coal. Okay, so enough of that, but I just want to quick do an update. I still have the 10% discount across the board on all products on my sales page. So that includes all the water filter items, my personal water filter product line, which I'm very proud of, the water filters, the pre-filter, the modular filtration and storage system, where you have 6.5-gallon screw-top containers that form the water filtration system, and then three of these tanks, 6.5-gallon tanks for storage, and then you can add more tanks if you like by buying two extra tanks at a time. So that's 13 gallons in every two tanks. And this is something that's really, really important. A lot of people have purchased this and are really happy with it. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time. Of course, all the books, DVDs are there. All the books except the Calculate Prime book in the ebook format. And so the books are either available in ebook format or in print format. And now available you can purchase the entire library of books and DVDs and CDs. Okay, but go to the webpage jmccsci.com and get the information there. I won't say any more on the air because the webpage is something you should be spending a lot of time on if you're very serious about what I talk about and also about preparedness. And I don't sell a lot of items like flashlights or rope or other preparedness items. You can get those in many places. Many good places sell preparedness items, but I concentrate on the essentials, the water filters and the pre-filter, which is a very important item, and then my books and DVDs, and then, of course, the recalendar Sun Star Clock. Make sure you check that out. On to the main science topic. Positive science, how to live in this very dynamic, very changing environment that we live in. And let's go back to the very source of all energy, the sun. If it were not for our sun, the solar light and the light that comes at us in all the wavelengths, but more so the electrical conditions, I was just reading where scientists still don't understand what causes rain. Now you would think, well, gee, the clouds are there, they have moisture in them, and it should just rain. That should be a natural byproduct of clouds. But remember, clouds are made up of microscopic particles of little droplets of water, and that's what a cloud is constructed of, microscopic beads of water. But how do these coalesce to get raindrops that are big enough to then fall? Because along with condensation and building up the droplets, they are evaporating. They are giving off water molecules from the drops of water. So the natural occurrence, the natural state of things in a cloud is that the water droplets are evaporating as fast as they are forming. So how do the water droplets form? And so, of course, what I would say is that it's an electrical effect, that the water droplets are in the clouds. There's a vertical electric field. The water droplets are discharging the vertical electric field, and through electrical forces, just like a comet, drawing in the tail material, it's forming larger and larger droplets. And once they get to a certain size, then they can fall out of the clouds. In fact, we would not even have clouds if it were not for the vertical electric field of Earth. This brings me into my first major topic tonight. In water, where does water come from? All the water on Earth came from either Earth passing through a large comet tail, or the fact that Earth is pulling in water from space, outer space, from the tail side of Earth, all the time. We're pulling it in at a constant, or seemingly constant, rate. But what happens is Earth is acting like a comet. Earth is acting like a comet and is slightly electrically charged negatively. It interacts with the solar wind, and we are drawing in water. So what happens with this water? Well, it goes into storm systems. It slowly, very slowly raises our ocean levels and lake levels. And a lot of it goes into the hydrological cycle that cycles water up to the north and south poles. Remember that every year the north and south pole gain quite a bit of ice. They get deeper and deeper every year. So what this is the result of the water coming in and being cycled up to the north and the south pole. It's a hydrological cycle, and that's what I talk about in the weather book. I also describe how that works. But the point is that we are constantly taking on water. But the big gulps, the big infusions of water come as we pass through the tail of a large comet. And of course, standard science has to have their little comet explanation for where the oceans come from. But there's a lot of things they can't explain. For example, why does Lake Superior and the Great Lakes, why are they fresh water? Why is there no salt in those areas? Well, just little snowballs hitting Earth doesn't explain that. Because in an average little snowball, there's not enough water or ice to even form the tail of a comet, let alone provide Earth with oceans. But a more vexing problem is, like I say, where do the oceans come, where does the salt come from in oceans? And then you have areas like Lake Superior that have no salt. Well, the reason I explain in my weather book is because the Great Lakes were glaciated up until a few thousand years ago, and when the glaciation left after the pole shift, when Venus the comet came by, or possibly other encounters with large celestial objects in the form of a comet, the Great Lakes were formed only recently, and that's why they don't have any salt. and you find other areas that are extremely salty. You find the salt beds of Utah, and you have other salt deposits that are deep, buried deep in the earth, obviously from oceans that existed long, long ago, with higher concentrations of salt than our oceans today. So the earth has undergone radical, radical changes throughout its history. And to try and put a date of 4.5 billion years based on surface rocks is more than absurd, absolutely absurd. But the point is that water is constantly coming into planet Earth. And in fact, a number of thousands of years ago, we had an ocean rise of many hundreds of feet. Some people say as much as 600 feet rise in the ocean levels. And of course, that was due to the Great Flood of Noah. And this was a torrential downpour of rain that lasted 40 days and 40 nights. So you're adding a tremendous amount of water across the earth. And remember, all the water that was on the land eventually flowed into the ocean, and so raising it by a couple hundred feet. So over the course now we have seen these kind of torrential rains where there's 10 inches in an hour. That's the kind of torrential rain that went on, but for 40 days and 40 nights. So at any rate, water is a precious commodity, but we have lots of it on planet Earth. We have a tremendous amount of water, fresh water, and it's being grossly mismanaged. In fact, it's being mismanaged to the point where there are contrived water shortages to cause ownership of water. And was it last week or the week before I announced that there were 11 major U.S. cities that are going dry? They simply don't have any water left. So it's really kind of an amazing situation. But this does not have to be this way. When this, as I explained, as the spring runoff occurs, we should be funneling that water instead of just flowing down the major riverways and out to the ocean. We should be funneling that water into large reservoirs where it is actually used throughout the year for farming, for irrigation, drip irrigation, very conservative forms of very efficient irrigation of plants, and for household use. But, of course, if you're in the business of making money over water, you certainly don't want anybody like me coming along and proposing such a ingenious and practical idea that would save the water that we have available for free just by putting the infrastructure in to divert this water. But of course, as I've said, there's no profit in that. On my webpage, I sell stainless steel water bottles. They come in 27-ounce and 40-ounce sizes. And what I want to encourage people to do, and of course, what I sell are the very high-end, top-of-the-line stainless steel bottles, the kind that will be around in 5,000 years. They'll still be there and somebody will still be using them. But you can also get, of course, the cheaper version, aluminum ones, very inexpensive, any place. What I'm encouraging people to do is get yourselves some reusable water bottles. I would avoid plastic, even though they say it is food ready. When you're here's the problem. Your water bottle goes in the sun, it goes in the cold, it sits in the freezing car, and that's what leaches the chemicals out of the plastics. And so, for example, I sell a plastic water filter. The plastic housing is approved for food. It's the high-density polyethylene plastic. But with any plastic, you don't want to like leave it in the sun, because the sun, the UV light from the sun, just destroys plastic and will leach out the chemicals eventually over long term. Also, they've found that freezing plastic will cause the chemicals that are in the plastic to leach out into the water. So, at any rate, metal bottles. For long-term use, get metal bottles. The cheap aluminum kind, or if you can afford the super kind at my website, stainless steel, would, like I say, last you forever. But please start using reusable bottles for water and stop supporting the Pepsi-Cola and the Coca-Cola and the Nestle's companies that are putting water in plastic, those cheap, thin plastic containers that are not recyclable, and they end up in vast amounts. I have a picture of a beach that's down in the Caribbean on a national park. I took a picture, and you can see all the plastic bottles that have washed up from cruise ship dumps, from people in boats that come by, and all of that ends up on the beach somewhere, and it's just a giant mess. So when you throw a bottle away, it ends up someplace, and it's probably not a good place. So reusable water bottles, that's one thing I want to stress in 2014. And I just noticed a little mistake on my notes for this page. I put 2013, just a little slip. Remember, on checks and documents, things like that, remember to put 2014, as we are now happily in 2014. So at any rate, continuing on the vein of water, we have to, as a society, start harvesting water in the natural way that nature intended. Now, first of all, we have the Greenland ice cap, we have the Antarctic ice cap, where we should be harvesting water. There should be large tubes that run up to the land masses, to Patagonia in South America, and across to the Northwest Territories of Canada, harvesting the great amounts of fresh water that are melting from the North Polar Cap, from Greenland, and the South Polar Cap. That's where about 90% of the world's fresh water is contained, and it's melting. So we have to harvest that and use that water. There's something that I have defined. It's called the centrifugal pump. Now, imagine this. The world is spinning. Our Earth is spinning on its axis. And that causes a centrifugal force. In other words, if you took a tube of water and you put it, a source at the North Pole or the South Pole, and you ran that tube out along the Earth, it would flow naturally in that tube without any assistance at all because of centrifugal force, because the Earth is spinning. And so that's one way to move the water. The other is just simply through wind power, putting wind pump stations along the way. And by the way, that's one of my projects that's coming online here very soon, is the ability to, I'm changing the wind industry, basically, with new innovative work that will cause a revolution in the wind industry. So that's coming online. And basically, I've done a couple of radio shows. One was on Coast to Coast AM, and I've done some other radio shows talking about, and plus my own, talking about the myth of alternative energy. And one of the biggest disasters in alternative energy has been the three-blade wind generator, electrical wind generator. And first of all, much of the wind, as in ancient times, it should have been used directly for water pumps and other forms of work, performing work locally where the wind generator is, and forget converting it to electricity. Conversion to electricity is extremely inefficient. Then you have to move it. Then you have to convert it back into light, electrical light, or run it through a three-phase motor. The biggest uses of electricity in the United States and the industrialized world is in lights and in three-phase motors. And a lot of that energy is lost just in the generation, the very inefficient generation, the transport, and then the recreation of energy in some form, electrical lighting or movement of three-phase motors. It's really, really inefficient. So I encourage the use of wind power at the source. And that's something I'll be talking more about during this coming year. So I have the three W's. And I'm not talking about the www.internet. I'm talking about water, wind, and weather. So the third form of creation of benefit that we need to use is the control of weather for the benefit of man, instead of the insane military people who've handed this off to even more insane upper banker populations that are using water and weather control to damage mankind. We have to use that. Imagine this, that those big Pacific storms that are constantly coming in off the Pacific Ocean into the western United States be directed down towards the southwestern United States. If we had rain in the southwestern United States, we could grow all of the vegetables and fruit necessary for the entire planet Earth to live on, a very good existence. Imagine that. But we have about a third of the United States in the American Southwest, actually more than a third, probably 40%, which is dry and unproductive. Imagine the all of the areas up through Colorado Springs into Colorado, Wyoming. Imagine that blooming and having much more fertile pasture for animals and grass-fed beef without chemicals. I'm imagining a future here that brings us with high quality of life, with the least amount of expense, and taking the chemical out of the production cycle. Just imagine, this is a kind of a fun fact, that if the huge buffalo herds that existed when the white man first came along and killed them all off down to a population of about 50, if those original buffalo herds existed today as they did back in the Great Plains, the early days of the American Southwest, there would be enough natural production of meat to feed the entire United States for free. Imagine that. Just imagine that. So clearly, I want to talk about freedom, water, transportation, food, shelter, health, and live within your own means. I want to talk a little bit about shelter. And if you have a 30-year mortgage and you're just making ends meet, you are living in a house that's far too expensive for your budget. Of course, the bank will give you a loan and they'll let you work and you'll think you're doing just fine, but you end up at the end of every year not a penny to your name. Well, you're in the trap. You're in the trap that the bankers want you in, and you are basically a slave because you cannot move and you're never going to get ahead. You're never going to get a dime ahead of anything. So, at any rate, this is a good time to change houses, to change locations, to change jobs. A lot of people are unemployed. This is a time for innovation. A lot of the millions that are made many times, the millions that are made and the new concepts that are brought about occur during tough times because the people are forced to jump to new concepts. They don't have a steady job. They have to be innovative. They have to find new ways to exist. And so what I'm saying is, as a society, if you're one of those people that's unemployed, if your things are not going well, look at what you're doing. Are you beating your head against the wall that is never going to, it's just the wall is getting bigger and bigger and you're beating your head harder and harder? Look around and see, wow, and you know, this isn't working. We can't keep doing this. And get out of the trap. Get away from the banker trap, the thing that's basically got the entire world entrapped. What do you need? You need a place with clean water. You need a place with food, a shelter that's comfortable, and a place where you can spend more time with your family. I met a family recently in the last couple months, and that's what they did. And I talked to them, and they were very happy. They lived in a house that had old floors. There was a lot of mud because it had been raining near where they were. And so they basically the house was a bit disordered because they just moved in, and they started a small business. All of the members of the family worked in the small business, and they were trying to make ends meet. And the woman worked at another regular kind of job. I won't say exactly what. That paid a relatively okay amount of money, and with this, the family sustained. The husband ran the business. They were there every day. It began to grow, and they offered local services that the community started to buy, etc. And so they became successful in a small way, but they were happy. And I talked to both the husband and wife of this family. And I said, what brought you to this part of the world, you know, and what was your plan? And they said, you know, we just got tired of the rat race in the city and running around and paying the bills and never getting anywhere. And we just had to get away. And so they were always looking for something. They found this little business to buy. And so they bought it. They used some of the cash they had saved to buy the business. And the kids converted to being in more a rural setting. It was, you know, it was just something they had to do. This is not for everybody. A lot of people are stuck in their city life, and they're not going to move from that. That's the only thing they know. But there's a lot of people also who are just like, you know, this is not for me. And they feel trapped. So look around, find out, be innovative, and look for change, and then have confidence that you can pick yourself up every day and go out there and work and make your own future, kind of that pioneering spirit. And, you know, you look at the pioneers that came across the country, the U.S., they didn't have much. They didn't have much to go on. Things were pretty thin. But they worked hard, they were consistent, and a lot of today, I'll be honest with you, I see a lot of loafers. I see a lot of people using other people in the family. There's good-natured people that work hard, and there's some other people who just use them. They're takers. They take they never come in with a bag of groceries, they never pay for a car payment, but they're always there to use it. They're always there like it belongs to them. And if you have people like that, you know, just kind of shy away and just kind of become invisible. And, you know, just not there when the phone rings, things like that. If you have people that are leeching off you, you know, even though they're family members, I hate to say this, sometimes, you know, missing some meals is a pretty big incentive to get your act together and go to work. But as long as somebody keeps providing the meals, the food, the gas, the car, sure, there's people that'll take it and use it and abuse it and continue to use it. So at any rate, it's kind of what they call tough love. But you've got to understand that as the Earth came out of the last disasters that were caused by comets rolling through the solar system, having great effects on Earth, people had to get tough. There was no option. They either got tough, they made their way, or they didn't make it. Very simple. Very simple. And so what's going on now with the economy of the world is that the government and the bankers want you completely dependent on them. They don't like people that are independent. They don't want you to have your own source of water or food or transportation or shelter. They don't want that. They don't want people who are not totally bound up in their health care system. And they don't want people that live within their means. Every day in the mail, you're going to get 3 or 4 credit card applications. They want you on that credit. Boy, that's the first step into falling down on your knees and being sucked in and drawn into the into a big mess, financial mess, because if you don't have money to pay for the whatever you're buying, when, if you're buying it on credit, well, how are you going to pay the credit back? Because you're not going to have money next month either. It's just too easy, and that's the old kind of the. A lot of people who are takers, they found things too easy. They got things that didn't belong to them, and then credit comes along, and wow, they can just jump in and get all that stuff, but then they can't pay it back. So just as I say, beware and keep your things small. Keep it within your family. Family units are the best way to work because you have affinity towards the family unit. Partnerships rarely work out because before too long, one of the partners gets greedy. One of the partners thinks, I'm not getting enough out of this. I'm doing more than my share and I'm not getting enough, and the partnerships break down. Partnerships rarely work. And so at any rate, just a few small items. But what does this have to do with the formation of the solar system? Well, when the solar system formed and during planetary formation, when other large comets came through the solar system, the Earth was renewed. And you see that in the Colburn, for example. And by the way, if you want to get this book, Kolbrin, go to the chaldeantrust.org website. It's linked on my webpage, and they will give you a referral where you can get the original Colburn. Don't buy the one you find on Amazon. Send that one back if you mistakenly ordered it, and get your money back. But the Colburn talks about the rebirth of man, the rebirth of Earth, through the giant comets that have come through the solar system. And it wasn't just one. There's not just one planet X. And that's one of the biggest myths that has been propagated over the last 15 years since this whole term Planet X started to come out and become popularized. Remember that the term Planet X simply means it's an astronomical term for an item that has not been named yet. It's been discovered and not named yet, so a planetary type object. But the whole kind of Looney Tune aspect of Planet X that's cropped up in the last 15 years has brought about the concept that there is only one Planet X type object, and that's simply not true. And the ancient texts talk about this. The misinformation specialist would love to have you believe that there's only one Planet X. Then they can manipulate it and say, well, it was supposed to come in May 15, 2003, and it didn't come, therefore it doesn't exist. You know, just small steps of bad logic like that, because there are many Planet X type objects, and you will see them in the form of a large comet. They will form a comet just like small planetary objects, like small asteroidal objects. And yes, they can affect Earth. They can have minor effects, or they can have large effects on Earth. I also want to talk about lifestyle. I talked to a friend of mine the other day who had a heart problem recently. And from the neighborhood, around where this person lived, there were no less than two deaths and a number of other people who had heart conditions developed to where they had an ambulance or an emergency responder come to their house. This is right in a small area. And so here's the problem. People who live in the northern climate are very sedentary. They sit, they eat very poor diets. They don't know they're eating a very poor diet. You tend to eat more meat and potatoes and heavy food and go light on the salads and fruit. On a cold day, eating fruit for breakfast really doesn't cut it. You need eggs and cereal and milk and sugar. And then for lunch, you eat a hamburger, and then you sit at work. And then for supper, you come home, you have a big meal with meat and potatoes and vegetables, then you sit down and watch TV, and it doesn't take long. Then all of a sudden, you start putting on pounds, your heart becomes weaker, and your cells become weak because they're not active. So anyway, the whole issue of health is an active lifestyle. And I have taken courses in various types of health just so that I could learn how to become healthy myself. And the biggest thing you have to learn is exercise and stretching. Stretching is very important. I took an anatomy course from a professor. He was from India, and he was a doctor in the United States, but he was giving this course in anatomy. And what he said is, first of all, you should eat what your ancestors ate, because that's what your body is most accustomed to chemically, the chain of food that came historically from your genetic chain. Mine in particular, from Ireland, fishermen and potato farmers. So, in fact, I love fish and potatoes. It's one of my favorite meals. I could eat it every day, three times a day. And, you know, so that's just in my system, but it's a very good meal. But look at what your ancestors ate, but keep a very active lifestyle. And there was a time when I was a bit heavier. If you see some of the videos on YouTube that are older, they portray me as a much more rounded person. And, of course, now I'm much more trim and fit, and I feel a lot better. But that's also how you can detect that a lot of the YouTube videos are taking old footage of me, old voice clips of me, and then somehow mixing it and saying that putting a title on it like Comet Ison 2 is Nibiru. For example, that's one falsified YouTube video of me. And there are hundreds and hundreds of them. But at any rate, look on my webpage. I have a post. I'm not going to waste radio time. But I don't post on YouTube. I never have, never will. It's a garbage pit of misinformation, especially when it comes to science. Okay, I've got a few minutes left on this program. Remember what I'm talking about: positive science, moving into the future, creating an environment that's successful, that's sustainable. That's a term that we should all become familiar with. Water, wind, weather control, and transportation, food, your own source of these as much as possible, shelter, have a shelter that's reasonably priced, or hopefully you can just pay for it, and then start living an active lifestyle. I'm out of time here, but remember to visit the webpage, jmccsci.com. That's JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.